And we are back. Thank you so much for sticking with us. And for now, and now is my favorite time of the show. Got a guest with us coming for the... I think this is actually a guest that is joining us from the furthest... the furthest away. I'm trying to think of a more erudite way to say that. This is the... Geographically, this is the longest distance interview that we've connected with. And we've got a very smart guy and going to give us some good international insights to what's going on in the world. Anyway, without further ado... Mr. Chris Stark, Dr. Chris Stark, is joining us today. Chris, thank you so much for being here. I'm so glad to get you on the show, man.
It's a pleasure, Zach. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah. So you are, before we get started, we're talking to you from Hong Kong right now, right? You're living in Hong Kong.
That's correct, yeah.
A Brit in Hong Kong. That sounds like the title of a movie, right? A Brit in Hong Kong. Why don't we start there? Because you're about my age. You've got a fascinating career, so I'd like to get the listeners to know a little bit more about you. You also do a podcast. I've been on your podcast before. So tell us how you got to Hong Kong, what you do. Kind of give us that background summation and how you and I end up connecting, because you've done a – for being a guy that's my age, you've done a lot more than I have. You've traveled a lot more than I have, and kind of give us that career arc and how you got to where you're at.
Sure. So I always make the joke, I'll try not to be British and give the 20-minute version, so we'll try and keep it short. Brits are well known for that. So I originally am a scientist. So I did a PhD in superconductors, hence the doctor, and it really is Dr. Dark. And that was at Oxford University. But at the time I was doing that, I started my first esports business. So this was back in 2002 when esports was not cool. In fact, everyone said I was insane. Now I was early, but we hosted some big tournaments for the time, like $150,000 tournaments, which back then was actually pretty significant. Now that would be kind of nothing. And then I basically realized academia wasn't the right place for me, but I did finish my PhD, and then I went to Bain & Co. for a few years, like the consulting firm, just to get a bit of basically just business knowledge. And so I did the typical kind of 3 years there, and then after that I pretty much became an entrepreneur. I mean, I already was, but I sort of stumbled into knowing the Skype founders, and they were starting Atomico, which is a large European VC. Except at the time, it was a non-existent European VC. And so I actually helped them set that up. I was there for a few years. And then I fell in love with a company actually in Kansas City, out of all places. And I wanted to invest in it. But the company's called C2FO. It's a large working capital marketplace, now very large. And the CEO and founder... who is a person called Sandy Kemper, who's a well-known figure in the Midwest, said, hey, why don't you come and build the business internationally for me? Because it was really a US-only business at the time. So I just said, sure, that sounds awesome. I had no idea he was going to ask me this. And I became the only person outside the US. And then so I built that business in about 15 different countries around the world. And that's why I moved to Asia. So about 5 years ago, I moved to Hong Kong. Really because the big opportunities for that business were Greater China and India. Now, I've skipped a few businesses I did that didn't work out so well, which is the kind of, usual thing. and then I got interested in macro kind of a couple of years ago. I was always a lurker on Twitter, and then started seeing people like yourself and other people talking about, this giant jigsaw puzzle. And so I thought, oh, that sounds kind of interesting. And so that's what I kind of put most of my time doing now.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, so it's an eclectic background. And then you've really, you have a passion, obviously, and an insight into financial markets, and you're an astute investor yourself. How did you spend some time at Bain? More on the consultancy side. How did that passion get rolling, and how did you get involved in markets and investing outside in public markets? It is. I mean, I you've done a lot of the entrepreneurial stuff, consulting side with Bain. What was that genesis that got you into financial markets?
Right. So, I mean, when I was a venture capitalist, you know, I was investing in private markets at Atomico, and so I did dozens of investments there. But that's very, very different. You know, you're talking kind of 10-year time horizons, illiquid markets. But that, you know, gave me, you know, some background in all of this. But really, in the last year or two, I mean, I've had some success. So I was like, well, okay, I better not screw up kind of the money I've made. And I didn't want to just give it to some large institutional fund manager, because I frankly don't trust them. So I thought it's probably better if I can try and work all this stuff out myself, and, you know, make the mistakes that everyone makes, learn from them. And, you know, so really, I mean, that was the number one reason. And it's also just really interesting. So, I mean, I like interesting things, and it seemed like a challenge. It's this giant jigsaw puzzle. No one knows the answer, and the answer changes every day. So,
Yeah, it's dynamic, to say the least, right? Okay, so there's that background, got that established. Let's fast forward a little bit, right to today, and one of the reasons I was excited to get you on is you've got a unique perspective of the world living in Hong Kong, right next to China, now the second largest economy in the world, and certainly a big factor. How are you seeing markets right now? How do you see them both internationally and then here in the U.S.? Kind of, you know, that is a very vague, overarching question. But what are you watching right now? What's of interest to you? What do you make of markets? Where do you think we are in the cycle? Do you think cycles exist anymore due to central bank intervention? Kind of give us your framework of what you're seeing in markets, what you're watching, what you like, what you don't like. Kind of give us your take on the world.
Sure. So I think in terms of, let's start with the cycle. So we're most likely at the end of a roughly an 80-year debt cycle, you know, which in effect ended last time in the 30s and 40s. And at the same time, we're at the end of an 80-year people cycle. So there's a great book that I read a long time ago, but has now become very fashionable again, called The Fourth Turning by Neil Howe. And he wrote it in the late 90s, and it was incredibly prescient in what it said. And in effect, he predicted there will be some major issue in the kind of around 08-09, which did happen. And then 10 years after that, would basically be the culmination of that issue, which is around now. And so what we're seeing is there's this fascinating intersection of the basically this four generational human cycle. So every four generations, there seems to be a big reset in how people go about their daily lives and how society functions. And at the same time, the debt cycle, it's no coincidence. It sort of roughly lines up with that too. So, you know, in terms of the, now, I mean, in terms of shorter term cycles, so, you know, for example, business cycles used to be kind of 4, 5, 6 years, and they're clearly longer now due to the central bank interventions. But I mean, you know, we're pushing on a string is a pretty, I think, you know, good analogy to what's happening right now. I mean, we're clearly at the end of a cycle. It's just who knows how long that can go on for. And, you know, it's... we live in a world where there are so many academic papers, and again, but a lot of people just want to dismiss all scientists and academics because, you know, they must be biased or stupid or whatever. I don't understand why they do this, but like, there's a lot of a huge amount of evidence to say, you know, if you overuse, let's say, land, labor, or capital, so capital, i.e., debt, you know, we've massively overused debt, and you just get diminishing returns. And that's exactly what we're seeing. And it plays out over a long period of time. You know, but also, you know, the US for some reason has, I mean, I don't know if it's the Cramer effect or what it is, but people seem very obsessed with stocks in general. Much less so in Europe. People own generally a lot more bonds. Although in places like China, you get very similar to US, actually, in terms of this obsession with stocks, because they've had, you know, massive growth in the economy. And again, you can believe or not believe the numbers, but at the end of the day, Tencent and Alibaba are gigantic companies that were merged incredibly quickly. And people that invested in those have made literally hundreds of X, just like people that invested, you know, in Facebook.
Yeah.
And they're deploying into more risk assets. And in a world of zero yield, pretty much, of course, people are forced up the risk curve. So, I mean, this links into everything, you know, to do with politics and election cycles and all sorts of interesting things. But we're basically living in a world where you're forced to go up the risk curve. Everyone knows it's unsustainable forever, but most people that manage other people's money, you know, have pretty short-term targets, and you know, they don't need to think on a long-term time horizon. Now, I think people investing their own money probably have the luxury of being able to be longer-term focused.
Yeah, well, it's funny you say that. I was lamenting the other day, just sitting there saying, you know, when you manage other people's money, you know, we don't like to talk about it, especially in front of investors. And I know some of my investors listen to this show, and that's fine because, you know, my attitude is I'm an open book, and I've told them this before. But, you know, the career aspect of this job it's real. And, you know, the longer term approach, if you underperform for 2.5 years in a row, a lot of investors assume you don't know what you're doing. And, you know, sometimes that's the case. Other times it's not, right? And trying to figure out the space in between. How much investing do you do directly into U.S. markets? Or would you say your portfolio reflects the fact that, you know, that you live abroad and reflects the fact that you live in Hong Kong? Or are you a U.S.-focused investor?
No, I'm U.S. and global, i.e., if you invest in gold, that's a global asset.
Right.
You know, I'd say, you know, or something like Bitcoin, for example, or commodities, they're global. But for markets, the thing I love about the US market is that it is highly regulated, super liquid, and it moves. I mean, you know, Europe has kind of, you've had to be prodding it with a stick for kind of the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And so actually it kind of is annoying because obviously it's overnight when the markets open. But I'm not investing in individual stocks and things like that. It's much more macro play kind of sectors or factors, and just broad asset classes. So, you know, what I'm really trying to think of, at the end of the day, you're trying to answer the most important question, I think, for most macro investors is the inflation question, which is incredibly hard to answer at the moment. You know, if we're going into an inflationary or very inflationary environment or a deflationary one or disinflationary one. And so that's probably the area I've put the most thought into. Because if you can get that right, and we may well be at another pivot point right now of the dollar moving up in the last few weeks. But again, it could also be a head fake. A lot of the trades that come from that are kind of pretty structural global trades, you know, whether or not you want to own gold or U.S. treasuries, which whilst they're a U.S. asset, they're really a global asset.
Right, right.
But yeah, I'm not buying kind of random crazy things in the, you know, the Thailand stock market.
Yeah. Okay. Now, one of the things, and I know that you and I have spoken a little bit off the air about this, and I know this is a tricky situation to discuss for, you know, there's very strong opinions on this topic. But one of the things I wanted to do, and I've got my opinions too, but I'm very conscious of the fact that I live in the United States. I always have. I've never even been to Asia. And I want to hear what you think about what is going on in China, both politically and economically. What you see as being the future between the two countries, the United States and China. And then also your unique perspective and how it probably differs from a lot of people in the West. And you and I were joking off air about how all too often it breaks down into this good guy, bad guy thing. And you know, it's not that I want one side to be the good guy or one side to be the bad guy, but I very much wish it was that simple. And it's just not. Kind of tell us how you see the rising tensions between the U.S. and China, and discrepancies or you know, raw or, you know, bad takes as far as the the U.S. side of it, the West side of it. What are some misunderstandings that you think that we may have about the situation? What do you think about the CCP in general? And, you know, just kind of the lay of the land as you see these two, because, you know, something that I don't think that we would disagree on is it sort of seems like you've got these two powers that have some, you know, there are some definitely some conflicts of interest between the two of them. I also think that there is, you know, ways to bridge that gap. But anyway, I would like to hear, because I think something that both you and I would agree on is that this isn't leaving the headlines anytime soon. And then how these two get along and go along will have a big impact on the rest of the world, economically, politically, all those kind of things. How do you see this scenario in your unique perspective living there in Hong Kong? And I would also like to hear your thoughts on what is going to happen with the Hong Kong-China situation. And have you seen changes already? You know, I'm throwing these large questions at you because I wish we had 3 hours to go over it and we could break down and, you know, dig deeper into each topic, but we don't. We've got to, you know, keep it somewhat contained. But how do you see things going on economically in China? How do you see a path forward, if there is one, with the trade relationships between the U.S.? Where do you see China politically right now and where they're headed? You know, and then the Hong Kong situation as well. Kind of give us a breakdown of where we're at politically, economically, as far as the China, U.S., Hong Kong situation goes.
Sure, I'd love to. And the reason I'd love to is I've been asked this question before and on other shows. And when I give my honest answer, I immediately get accused of being, you know, a puppet of the Communist Party or something like this. And so it's actually impossible for people here. What I mean is, if people here say what they think, people in the West immediately accuse them mm-hmm. of lying. And it's kind of ridiculous because we're allowed to have different opinions. And so I always ask people if they've been to China or Hong Kong, if they've spent time, or are they just reading Western media? And by the way, plenty written in Western media is pretty accurate, and a lot of it's not. So, and by the way, it'll be just the same in Asia, you know, media here about the West. So, you know, often the truth lies relatively in the middle. So in terms of the economy, your first question, I think what people don't realize so much about, and I'm going to just lump Hong Kong and China together for this, because it's a very similar dynamic in that the property market is incredibly important. Mm-hmm. And like it sort of was in the US in 08, but a little bit less so now because, you know, after that correction. And yes, you've got huge amount of debt in the banks and in the system. And I don't think anyone is denying that. Is it sustainable in the long run? No. But at the same time, you've got this giant economy of 1.4 billion people that used to be an economy that got a lot of criticism for, say, copying stuff from the US. But then what happened was something like WeChat came, which is vastly more functional than WhatsApp. Literally like 100 times more functional.
Yeah.
In terms of just what the end user can do with it. So yep. There's been a lot of innovation out of China. And again, some people don't like to hear that, but Mark Zuckerberg himself has said that. Let's be clear. There's US has been incredible at generating a lot of intellectual property over the years. And there are many countries around the world that have tried to, you know, play games with that.
And Chris, did interject one second here, just so the listeners understand. When you talk about the innovation, WeChat really is remarkable. It's sort of like a mix between like WhatsApp, Twitter, Venmo, right? I mean, it's so multifunctional, right?
If you don't have WeChat in China, you pretty much can't live. and it's owned by a private company. Now, of course, the private company, you know, it's going to be in discussions with the government. But by the way, you know, is this massively different to when Trump's trying to, like, you know, unilaterally do things? And again, I don't want to get into the Trump Biden thing, but you know, if you just kind of go a little bit below the surface, I don't think there are gigantic differences. Anyway, so the key thing in China and Hong Kong is the housing market. If the housing market had a huge, property market had a big crash, like a 50% crash like US did in 08, then that would be phenomenally difficult. It'd be super duper difficult for Hong Kong because it's even more focused on property. That basically is the Hong Kong economy. But it'd be very hard in China too. And I just don't see a world where that is let to happen. So we just live in a world where the Fed has in effect printed, and I know that's a loaded word, many trillions of dollars to prop up all sorts of failing businesses and also some businesses that weren't failing but had a bad card dealt with them due to the virus. And, the latter you could argue is probably pretty good. The former you could argue, well, why are you propping up businesses that were going to fail? But the kind of the last bastion out here would be if the property market fell that far, that's going to be very, very difficult for the governments out here. And I just don't think they're going to let it happen. But it could still happen. And if it does, then that's probably literally the last thing before you have kind of chaos. And I think a lot of people in the West don't understand how much would be done to prevent the market crashing. Doesn't mean it can't have a 10% correction, but a real crash. And again, an analogy might be, you could argue, is kind of, Trump at the moment with the stock market. He seems, it's not had a good couple of weeks, but, the speed of the recovery after the down in March, it took everyone by surprise. And every day, whether it be actions of the Fed or politicians, talking about the stock market every day, which never used to happen. So, these are the same types of tactics that can be used everywhere.
And I would even argue that the Chinese government has probably more levers and more control to stabilize that property market, don't they?
Yeah, because in effect, all banks of any scale are owned by the government. So, yeah, they can control the money. Well, central banks can control the monetary base, but in China, they can control that and also the money supply. In some ways, a bit like Japan did in the 80s, right? With
window dressing,
where the banks were told they had to lend, in the 80s and the 90s. So they have a lot of points of control. But again, it's a huge, complex country, 1.4 billion people, right? That's four times the size of America. It's the same size as America geographically. They're within 1% of each other in size. There's gigantic differences. I've been to maybe 10 different places in China. They're massively different. It's got a very rich history, and it's a complex country. Is it perfect? Absolutely no. There are lots of things that, I don't like about it, but it just has a different system, and one could argue the US in some ways has a 2-year electoral system. Every 2 years there's there can be huge changes to how Washington is made up, and that's not very long. Now, I'm not saying I think in the West people should have 10-year or longer systems, because the famous Churchill quote around democracy is bad, but it's better than everything else. It's roughly the quote.
Yeah.
So I'm not arguing that at all. But again, sometimes people hear that and they think, oh, Chris thinks that everyone should, have, a Communist Party. I'm not saying that at all. It's just it's a super complex situation. And Hong Kong itself, I know of a couple of people, families that have left, but they're sort of planning on leaving anyway. It's a place where Westerners don't tend to come for many decades. There are some that are. A lot of them are British from the kind of pre-1997 days. But it's a pretty common place. People come for a few years and then they go somewhere else. But largely, you got to remember we had the protest before. So this time last year, there was the protest. So we were having -35% retail sales before COVID.
Year on year.
And now we're getting the -35% upon the -35%. So if you look at it compared to 2 years ago, you're talking kind of whatever that would work out to be, -60% or whatever it is. So the economy's clearly got a problem. But in terms of daily life, for 99.999% of people here is utterly identical to what it was. And actually locally, so Hong Kongers generally did not like the riots because it was just, they were really just getting in the way of daily life. I mean, you know, when you're in central Hong Kong, for those that have been there, and there's kind of tear gas flying around, you know, it's not big central Hong Kong. That's not really conducive for business happening. And also I think there's, to some degree, there's an acknowledgement that, well, look, in 2047, no one knows exactly what the situation will be, but it's one thing is for sure, the 50-year agreement ends in 2047 with the UK. And I think, in effect, what happened is it got front run. And it got front run when then there was a global pandemic, and the world was pretty distracted. You know, stuff like this, the security law that came in was always going to come in at some point. And the locals I know here are not particularly worried about it. But again, that's not a popular thing to say. For example, you know, in the West, if you say that, then, you know, that's not what Fox News will tell you. So,
yeah, you're not going to hear that. Well, interesting thing, to kind of a two-prong question. A, there, it, and again, I don't have insight, you know, and I'm not listening to Eastern, you know, Eastern media. I'm clearly not living in Hong Kong. But in the West, you know, the narrative is that China is taking control of Hong Kong. Do you think, I mean, they are certainly front running that agreement, right? How soon do you think that they take over? Will they make up? Are they going to, you know, put window dressing on it and try to pretend like they're adhering to the 2047 agreement? Or are they going to, you know, take over? And is it going to officially become essentially, I guess, annexed and become a part of China? How is that going to happen? And what do people in Hong Kong think about it? That's the first part of the question. And then the flip side is, how is the China-U.S. thing, current trade standoff, if you will, and angst and the issues between the two countries, how is it seen on China's side of it? How do the citizens view the U.S.? What is their opinion? Is the vitriol balanced, meaning do you have just as much angst with the U.S. on the Chinese side of the issue as you do with Chinese on the U.S. side of the issue? How does that all balance out? So two very complex things, but A, how does the handover of power happening? Are they going to front run it from what you see? And then how will that go down? And then what do Hong Kongers think about it? And then again, what is the perception from Hong Kong and those in China of the U.S.? What is their read of the situation? Are they just as vitriolic or, you know, excited, if you will, in an oppositional way against the U.S.?
Yeah. So on the first question, let's remind ourselves of one thing. Hong Kong is part of China.
Right.
There is zero debate about that. I don't know anyone that debates that. I'm sure there's someone, but it's the same as Macau. It's a special administrative region. It's just Macau is very small, right?
But one party, two systems, right? When does it become one party, one system?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm not dodging the question. So so it is part of China. It is also very important to China as one could argue, you know, probably the world city in Asia. I mean, Singapore's up there. But in terms of how mainland Chinese can get access, and this includes companies, right, gets access to US dollars and enters the kind of global system, Hong Kong is really important. And Shanghai is just not there yet. It may be there in 20 years. But when I speak to, if you speak to people here, they want to be dealing with Hong Kong, not Shanghai, if they can. You know, when dealing with Chinese companies. And look, I built a business in China. It's it can be complex to move money around. You know, it's people complain about it sometimes in other countries, but it absolutely can be complex. So I mean, obviously, I don't know what's going to happen, but it would be odd to me. I mean, I think what's happened has happened. That's probably the extent of it for several years. Because they don't have a kind of replacement for Hong Kong yet. And maybe that will be Hong Kong for decades. Maybe it, in effect, going to force it to be Shanghai at some point. I'm sure that they have a view on what they want, and they're not going to say what it is publicly. So, you know, but I mean, again, in terms of day-to-day life, really, I mean, really nothing has changed. And I think that's not fun to report that because it's boring, but it is reality. In terms of China, US, I mean, come on, this is, yeah, this is a very tricky one. China tends to have long-term plans. Again, it goes back to the political system. And you can like or not like the system. It doesn't matter. The fact is they have a 10-year system. And then, you know, except recently that's been even longer. And so it means they can make long-term plans. So if you've seen the dynamics between China and US, a lot of people out here would argue, well, it looks like the US is being a bit more volatile. And maybe that's a Trump thing. But maybe Biden will be the same. Who knows? And China's playing a long-term game of they need to get less reliant on exports, but they still need to export. I mean, they still make a huge amount of things.
Yeah.
And of course, the middle class is, again, they've benefited from the rise of a lot of Chinese companies. They've made money. They have more money. They're spending it, domestically. You know, and that's really, you know, retail sales in China. I mean, it grows before COVID. You know, you got double-digit growth year on year some months,
right?
I mean, and normally always high single-digit. So, I mean, that's serious growth when you've got 1.4 billion people. You know, so, and again, with you don't hear about it so much these days with COVID, but with initiatives like Belt and Road, it's kind of, you know, the modern version of the Silk Road. You know, they're making huge investments in a lot of countries, and they're not doing this out of the goodness of their heart. I mean, obviously they have an agenda. And, you know, the big question for the next 50 years, you know, could well be, you know, is the US hegemony when it comes to money, you know, is that going to come to an end? And it doesn't just happen overnight. But again, if we talk about cycles, you know, the longest cycles tend to be things like reserve currencies. And, you know, or are we going to move to a world which is a bit more kind of geographically split, you know, which is possible too. And if that happens, you know, the player in Asia will be China. I don't think there's much debate about that. You know, it's India's got the same number of people, but it's, you know, much, much, much less in terms of, you know, its economic capacity and GDP.
And much more societal constraints just at this point, you know, culturally, the way they're set up, right?
Yeah, and also just infrastructure in India is poor.
Right.
And I've spent a lot of time in India. And yes, there's beautiful buildings in the big cities, but you don't need to go far in Delhi away from, say, the administrative region or in Bangalore or Bombay, wherever you are. And yeah, you will not see that in China. So, you know, India's a wonderful country, but it's still got a long way to go. But it will become the world's second biggest economy. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah.
It's just a function of how many people it has. So.
Right, right. Yeah, even if their output is one third of the US, right?
Exactly. It's got four times the population. I mean, you know, demographics is one thing that's pretty simple to project in the long run. You know, it's easier than the stock market projecting in the next day. So.
Yeah. Okay, so interesting insight. And one of the reasons why I wanted to get that take from you is, this is a really complex world that is getting increasingly complex by the day. And I think if we approach things in a black and white stance and don't have the mental dexterity to flip around and look at something from another angle, you know, we were joking before you and I got on the podcast, we were joking about the idea that, you know, it's good versus evil. And yet people need to be reminded that on all sides of the conflict, the participants think they're the good guy fighting the evil guy, right? And I like to hear that, and I appreciate that take. You know, it's we have families, we have good, you know, there's dreams and aspirations and the same desire for, you know, Chinese have the same desire for their family that we do in the West, right? For their children to have a better life than we, you know what I mean? It's more complex than, you know, bad, good, that kind of thing. Let me put you a little bit on the spot on this topic, though. What is, and I have opinions on this, but my opinions are loosely held because, again, I know that I'm looking at it through a red, white, and blue stained lens. What is your take on Z? Do you see him as, you know, an authoritarian, a true authoritarian figure, or do you think he's taking authoritarian measures in the short term to shore things up? What do you make of him? Is he beloved in China? What again, from that side of the pond, I know that your perspective living in Hong Kong on that situation is going to be unique to mine and the people listening to this podcast, but how is Xi seen both by you and by the populace in general, and how did they take to that lifetime appointment? You know, for the United States, that seemed like, oh, that's, you know, that's just proves that, you know, he's an authoritarian, and I sympathize with that argument, obviously, but I don't live in China. How is he perceived?
Yeah, so I mean, it's a little harder to comment on. I mean, I'm in Hong Kong, not China, so this doesn't get talked about as much in Hong Kong, but from my trips to China, like, what I've understood on this one is, so first of all, the big thing he did remember is this anti-corruption drive. So China had, like, it's amazing how many politicians lived a life that was, let's say, a little bit more luxurious than they should have been living. One could argue in lots of countries, by the way, that's the case.
That doesn't happen in the U.S., Chris.
Of course not, because if you looked at the average, if you looked at how much every senator is worth based upon the salaries, excluding the ones that have family money, anyway.
The funnier one is to look at what they're worth prior to going into office and what they're worth 2 years out.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So let's be clear. This type of corruption in politics happens everywhere. Right. I think we all know that. It's a human thing. So he really, really took that on big style. This was back in maybe 13, 14. It was quite a few years ago. And he's actually going on a second wave of it now. It's almost like COVID. So there's a new wave coming, he said, because and there'd be some high profile arrests recently. This went down very well.
Now, and this and Chris, I don't mean to cut you off, but this was not a cover for the extermination of political opponents, and we're just going to call it anti-corruption. It was true anti-corruption drive. I mean, it really was.
Well, look, again, this is where there's gray area. You know, I mean, this. I think the scale of it, people don't necessarily understand. You're talking about thousands, if not tens of thousands, of different cases. This wasn't like three senators, right?
Oh,
you're
wow.
talking about a huge number, and out of those, you've got the whole spectrum of people that, you know, maybe. You know, who were just blatantly corrupt, through to people that were disagreeing, and this is where the argument gets more grey, right? And you know, it's hard to just paint. It's not a simple picture. Now, in terms of the life appointment, again, like, my understanding was that went down. Like, people were pretty relaxed about it because they're like, okay, he's done a good job at the kind of purging a lot of the people who are corrupt. Now, I'm fully aware you can make the argument the other way, right? Saying, well, he's purging people that disagree with him. But also, you know, the way the system works there is, and they've had this system for, you know, 70 years now, is whoever's in charge has the power. It's not like the US or indeed most of Europe, where there's different chambers and things moderate each other. You know, so if you're the president, if you're Xi, your amount of power you have versus the prime minister is in effect infinite, right? Because, and so, I can see that there's an argument which was, well, okay, well, clearly people can't go and protest, except they kind of, there are ways. It may not be physical, but remember, again, electronically, we just saw what kind of happened with, say, TikTok in US with that rally Trump had in Tulsa, I think it was. There are lots of ways that people can protest, but it's not as visual as having a lot of people in the streets. But I mean, I think, again, a lot of it's not just a China thing, but in Asia, you've got people are more. You know, whether it be Japan or, I mean, especially East Asia, less so maybe in Southeast Asia. But people do kind of look up to people in power more than I think they do in the West, where the media every day will bash politicians of both sides. And that's fine. That's good, too. They're just different systems. But, you know, in terms of the way I see this good v evil thing is very much, again, what Neil Howe said in The Fourth Turning. Because what people aren't talking about is what's the first turning, which is, so when you have this fourth generation where basically everyone hates each other in the world, which is where we are right now, what something catalyzes a move to the first turning, which is when actually there's suddenly a lot of widespread agreement, new people are around, and they actually kind of agree, and they're like, oh, wait a minute, we're going to avert the world kind of destroying itself. And often this is normally a war. So obviously it was, you know, you had the Second World War was a very obvious example. Then the 50s and 60s in US was a first turning where actually a lot of agreement on not everything. And then things suddenly go downhill again. So, you know, with leadership in the world hopefully getting younger at some point. Now Europe's leading the way in terms of having prime ministers that are in their 30s and early 40s. Leo Varadkar in Ireland, Macron in France, Kuntz in Austria. Obviously, Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand, not in Europe. But again, there are people here who are under 40 or around 40. But you tend to see older politicians in Asia and the US. And obviously, in the US election right now, this is a pretty good example. You've got two people who are, I can't remember if Trump's 75 or 74, but you know, 74, 75 and above.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, I still believe in like humanity and we're going to get through this super kind of crazy period where frankly no one can agree on anything. And it's kind of ridiculous. And there'll be listeners saying, oh, well, Chris is just saying this stuff because he has to. This is complete rubbish. Like if you're an expat in Hong Kong, believe me, if I want to leave tomorrow and go somewhere, I can. Well, apart from COVID.
Right. Yeah.
It's like a separate point. Yeah. Whether the country I want to go to will have me is a separate point. So, you know, I'm just trying to kind of call the ball as I see it. But it's a phenomenally complex issue. And, you know, are US and China going to get along well for the next 50 years? Probably not. Why? Because ultimately, in that period, China's GDP will exceed the US's, almost certainly. And therefore, the US is not the world's biggest economic power. Now, when that happens, of course, people have different debates on, but I haven't seen any forecast where it doesn't happen in the next 50 years.
I can't. I've looked at those numbers and I can't get there in terms of, yeah, how it doesn't over. I mean, how it doesn't overcome. Like you pointed out, and I think there's people in the West that feel threatened by this. And I'm just like, hey, guys, it is what it is. It doesn't mean that we can't be competitive, right? Because I think, you know, innovation, you know, it's not all about just manpower. But when you understand the population difference, I mean, China's got some demographic issues, but those demographic issues aren't going to lead to a 50% reduction in its population, right? So, you know, it's just like you said, it's just a population issue. It is literally a matter of time, isn't it? I mean, it's baked into the cake.
Yeah, I mean, if you go to Shanghai, it feels like you're in any super modern Western city. Oh, except you've gone on a magnetically levitated train from the airport, admittedly to get to a kind of silly part of Shanghai, which isn't where you want to go. But, you know, they have some serious technology. And you know, the point is, if you're in somewhere like a Shanghai and you didn't know where you were and you didn't know the landmarks, you could be anywhere in the West. And so, you know, and you've had a lot of move, you know, you've had the same rural to urban migration. And now that might be reversing in lots of places. But at the end of the day, you've got four times more people.
Right.
So, you know, and GDP per capita, that means it can be a quarter of the US and you're going to have the same size economy.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, it's better to think of it that way. I mean, do you really think in the long run they're not going to get to a quarter? They're going to get way past that. Of course they will.
It's just a matter of time.
Yeah. And you're right on the population. India will probably have a vastly larger population in years to come. So you could argue in the very long run, India may overtake. But then you're talking triple figure years out.
So well, yeah, because they've got a massive, massive deficit on the technological side of things and also on the infrastructure side of things.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, and I appreciate the, because I've been hard on China at times, and yet the thing that always goes through my mind is, you know, I'm reading one side of the page. You know what I mean? And I've paid for that type of logic in the past.
You know, one thing that to add, though, is I think a lot of people out here in East Asia, especially, and this is not Southeast Asia. So East Asia, I'm basically saying Greater China, Japan, Korea. So, and you could sort of put Singapore in it just because it kind of has similar, some similar traits, but they're used to kind of pretty consistent messages from government. So look at Japan, right? They're 30 years in to, well, I mean, the Nikkei still hasn't got to its highs, right, from 89.
It's still, yeah, it's still 45% right. below it.
Right. And so, but people are used to kind of consistency from politicians, not flip-flopping. And they look at someone like Trump, or indeed Boris Johnson, you know, in UK or wherever it is. And so they look up to someone like an Angela Merkel, who's like, okay, kind of pretty, you know, you may or may not agree with her policies, but she's not flip-flopping every day, week, month. And then they look over to the US and they just see this complete, you know, Trump can literally change his mind every day on something. And then he'll claim he never said what he said before when everyone saw him say it. And they think that's kind of insane. And I know a lot of Americans think that's insane too, depending on kind of how they vote. But like, again, it's just looking at the, sometimes it's good just to look at a situation from a different angle.
Yep.
It doesn't mean you have to change your view. It's just kind of, because it is kind of crazy what's going on in U.S. politics right now.
And certainly with unprecedented.
Supreme, you know, with the Supreme Court thing, you know, I mean, this could be the kind of the escalation that just everyone's just going to keep one-upping the other, especially if the Dems win in November or December or January or whenever the election result might actually be known. And, you know, and US is already at breaking point. So again, a lot of people out here look at that thinking, well, whoa, there's big problems there too. So, you know, it's just, you know, it's always good to challenge one's view. And the issue with the world we live in is it can be, I mean, I can have a discussion with you about something we disagree on, but we have a discussion and we can have a beer afterwards or a virtual beer or whatever. The problem is a lot of the world can't have that discussion without it just turning into basically a bit of a crapshoot. The same happened with Brexit. It drove many families, including mine, apart. And that's kind of stupid. I mean, we were just humans on this irrelevant planet in a solar system that isn't in any way important, in a galaxy that's not important.
I think that one of the things that frustrates me here in the US, and again we could extrapolate this out to Brexit and all kinds of other scenarios, is that we know going into these arguments, you know, where you get these Mexican standoffs develop, where, you know, where we're now in the U.S. here politically, we're just at a point where, you know, both parties, you know, the vitriol is just through the roof, and both sides just take their ball and go home. And the frustrating thing for me is I look at them and I go, as adults, you should understand that you're not going to get 100% of your way. Right. So yet we have this, you know, this stalwart approach, if you will, or this immovable approach where we're not going to give in, and you go, okay, well then you're not going to get anything done, you know, and it's like compromise has become a dirty word. And the thing you realize is that, especially here in a system like the United States, it's not possible to move forward without it. Right. Like,
right. It was built for compromise.
Right?
Absolutely.
I mean,
and that's it's a very clever system in many ways, but all systems have advantages and disadvantages.
Right. Right. And that disadvantage of ours is being exploited. And in many ways, you can say that in that aspect, the Chinese system does have an advantage. More can get done and it can get done quicker.
Right. And I just want to doubly stress, I am not at all saying the world should follow Chinese system. It's just, I'm a firm believer in democracy. In fact, an answer to a lot, I get a lot of criticism from people when I say, well, actually, I think a lot of this will get resolved at the ballot box someday. Now, I'm not saying when, and I'm not saying that's in 6 weeks, but I still do believe that in countries where there's a democracy, and again, this may align with this whole kind of concept of different turnings, that the voters will still decide. And also at some point in the next probably 10 years in the US, and it could get really bad in that 10 years, but there will be a point where politicians do start to come closer together. And there may be no one may know why that happened. There could be a really bad event, like a 9/11 type thing. Let's hope that's not the case. But you know, often, you know, these things are very nonlinear. And just something happens, or you just get some younger candidates that actually are like, you know, we're sick of all this. And things can actually change quite quickly. So I'm still very upbeat on what can happen. The human race is incredibly innovative. And you know, we're in a world where, you know, the technology now compared to 100 years ago is just looks like magic. And, you know, technology will keep going forward. So, you know, it's not all kind of depressing, but I think the 2020s could be pretty tough. But I'm pretty optimistic about the kind of 2030s onwards.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, both with, you know, technological advances. And then here in the United States, you know, we get a real demographic wind at our back at about 2027, 2028, I think, maybe 2026, somewhere in there. But yeah, I agree with you. It looks like lean times between now and then. Okay, so pivoting to something else, because we are getting further into this, and I heard you, I think it was a tweet I saw or something like that. You and I have a very odd, well, maybe not, it's not odd to me, but we both have a similar fascination, and that is volatility. And I didn't know that the last time you and I talked, but and it's kind of an esoteric conversation, right? But kind of give me what it is that, you know, again, how you started, because when I talk to other people that are fascinated by vol and pay attention to it and follow it, because looking at vol in all kinds of different scenarios is part of my daily process. And it's very much a part of how I build a portfolio, and it may not be using it directly, but you know, what I'm hearing from vol, what I'm seeing from vol determines certain aspects of our portfolio on a regular basis. Kind of explain to me how, again, because it's not like, you know, people start out looking at the indexes or looking at individual stocks. Not a lot of people get into volatility. Kind of tell me how you started paying attention to volatility. Was it the VIX? Was it the MOVE index? Like what caught your eye? What got you interested in vol? And do you integrate it into your process? And if so, how do you use it as a hedge? What is your interest in vol, and what kind of spawned that focus of yours or that fascination?
Right. So I think the first thing to say is I think it's made very esoteric by a lot of people. Mm-hmm. A lot of people in the vol space honestly aren't the best communicators. They're super duper smart, but they start talking and 99% of people are just like, literally, that sounded like Greek, because right. They just used every Greek letter.
Yes.
That's a bad joke, but like, it's true. So I probably mid-19 or whatever, I was listening to some of these folk and I'm like, okay, this is interesting. So I'm like, okay, so at mid-19, I was of the view that the US economy seemed to be slowing down. But I mean, it ultimately did bounce a bit at the end of the year and then COVID hit. But I was like, okay, well, how do I get insurance? So on my long positions, and I risk on positions, indeed not always risk on positions like gold as well. And so I started looking into volatility, and it was very low at the time. And of course, when it's low, that's the exact time you want to buy insurance.
Amen.
And of course, no one buys it, because if people were buying it, it wouldn't be low. I mean, this right. is like, yeah. So I just dipped my toe into it. So I started buying like very long term, like literally there are some markets, not futures markets, with the exception of maybe euro dollars, but in most futures markets only have liquid vol markets for maybe 2 or 3 months out. So if you want to buy several years out, which you can do, you need to generally go into some kind of ETF. And so, for example, GLD is an example, right, for gold that has a very liquid, deep options market. So I was just thinking, I'm like, well, wait a minute. Like if volatility is like at the time for gold was like 10% or whatever it was, this is historically pretty low. And, you know, surely this is therefore a good time to just buy very long dated options that will go up in value if just volatility increases. And, you know, also, of course, have the chance to go up in value if the underlying asset goes up. And so I just kind of dipped my toe in. And then, of course, when you dip your toe into this space, you suddenly realize, you know, well, OK, I'm a complete noob at this at the moment. But then there's like a million other trades that kind of, you know, one can do. It's an absolute rabbit hole. And, you know, and then I So I've never touched things like... I also knew from 15 years ago that USO was very dangerous. I remember reading an article on it in 2005. And this was the oil ETF that uses... basically keeps rolling into...
futures future contracts, months. Right? Yeah.
And of course, when you're in contango, like, this is bad. Now, I read about it a long time ago when the oil market was backwardated, when actually USA was doing very well. And my point at the time was, oh, well, it's going to go into contango again and everyone's going to get wrecked. And so for the same reasons, it's a little more subtle, but and it's a bit more sophisticated, but the actual VIX ETFs, so like VXX, things like this, or VIXY, are not something I touch. If you invested $1 million in VXX 10 years ago, it would now be worth $1.
Yep.
And if you don't believe me, look at the chart.
Yep.
And the way, and don't get me wrong, these products do have a reason for existing. They're actually super liquid, but they're generally used by institutions for hedging at very, very short term time horizons.
Yep.
I don't think they're for retail traders. And actually, I think it's pretty poor that retail traders can just very easily trade these things because they're not understanding what's really going on. So, but the classic way you're going to go long vol is with, you know, with different options, and again, it doesn't have to be super complex. So, you know, people might be right now. Well, 2 months ago was a really good example. So volatility had gone quite low again, not as low as 19, which was really low, but things like SPY and other indexes were had pretty low vol, as did gold, and it was an interesting. But they'd all gone up a lot. So it was kind of an interesting time to maybe you could buy something like a straddle where you're buying a put and a call at the same expiry and at the same strike price. And that will generally go up in value if the asset moves either up or down. And that generally increases volatility. And so, again, it's just one of those things which no one talks about it until something happens. And then something happens, which means volatility goes up, which means all these things suddenly are more expensive. And then the way I like, and then people look at me and I'm like, well, just think about it. So that more expensiveness to volatility now is actually the return you would have got if you had bought it when it was cheap.
Right.
And which again is sort of obvious, but I think people get a little confused with all the terminology. So the key thing I did was just to dip the toe in very, very, very slowly, not go out selling options, which if you don't know what you're doing, can be dangerous. Mm. And I had someone push back on me on that once saying, well, you know, I sell options every day, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, this was someone who literally had 25 years experience as an options trader. I'm like, I'm talking about a new investor on Robinhood, for example, who has just found out what a put and a call option is. They really shouldn't be selling them.
They got introduced to the magic aspect of being able to sell a put and buy a call and not put any money up, right? And it's risk-free money to them.
Risk-free money, apart from you could have an infinite loss.
Right.
But putting the infinite loss aside, and like a lot of things, and this relates to the whole journey through macro, you've just got to, I think, dip your toe in, but you can't do it theoretically. You can't be trading paper money. You need to... And it might mean buying one call option of, not of Amazon, because that's a $3,000 share.
Right.
And obviously one call option is actually 100 shares. But do it maybe with a $10 share or $20. And it's, you know, just a really small amount of money that just means you can every day look at what that... Because whether it's a $100 position or $100,000 position or $100 million position, it's going to move the same amount each day. And just when it's there on your screen staring at you, that's the best way to learn how these things move, because there are unexpected things that happen. And I think there's for example, right now, a lot of people, you kind of misunderstand gold. They just think it's going to go up because the Fed's printed money. You know, the dollar's just gone up quite a lot in the last 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
That's really been negative for gold. The Fed's still printing money and they're sitting there scratching their head saying, well, how is this possible? And it's like, because it's more complex. So, you know, it's kind of got to ease into positions. But I think having some amount of long volatility in a portfolio, and it may just be a few percent, you know. So one thing I do is have long-term straddles on, say, SPY, which again has a deep long-term options market, maybe 9 months or 12 months, like expiry, and then I'll roll them when there's maybe 3 months left, because you get most of the options will decrease in value fastest at the end of the time, the last 3 months.
Yep.
And that's just a way of me always having insurance. And I'm happy to spend, say, or lose maybe 1% of the portfolio every year for that insurance, because the year that the insurance pays out, it's going to pay out, you know, gigantically.
Yeah. Well, and the other aspect of it too is it lets you, you know, it lets you press on other parts of the portfolio, you know, assuming they're the right parts, but it lets you press your bets on some other parts, knowing that, you know, yeah, you're getting a little aggressive, but you still have this backup, right? You still have this, you know.
Right. But I had an interesting learning with that too. And again, some people are going to just say, well, Chris, this is so obvious, you're so stupid. But for example, recently gold went up a lot, say 2 months ago.
Yep.
And I thought I'm going to be really smart, and I'm going to buy, I'm going to go long US dollar versus euro, because it's a hedge, right? Because US dollar is generally inversely correlated with gold. Not always. But at the time, it was like negative 0.98 or something, the correlation.
Yeah.
On like a 30-day basis. And actually what happened is gold went down, but the euro continued to strengthen. So the hedge I had, which was actually with call options, didn't work. And, you know, except I had exactly the right thought process, which was I need to hedge my gold gains. Except I did it the wrong way, because I was in effect being too clever for myself. And all I should have done was just buy some puts. Simple. Done. In gold.
Right.
And then I would have been hedged, because the only surefire way to hedge yourself on something is to buy the opposite of that same asset. And so that was a good lesson in how correlations can change. And they can change really quickly.
You and I don't mean to interrupt you, but that's a fascinating turn that this conversation has taken, because today is a perfect example of that, right?
Yes.
Unless you were short equities, that was the only way you could have hedged your portfolio, right?
Or long US dollar, but in a levered way.
Right, right. Like, yeah,
if you just had US dollars, they're still worth the same US dollars. So you either had to be short, whatever asset class, or levered long US dollar.
Right.
Yeah. I don't believe most people want to be in those types of positions.
And that's the interesting thing too about volatility and hedging in general. And I've had this conversation with our, you know, our employees, and have it with, you know, our other portfolio manager all the time, which is, you know, we throw around a word like hedged. You've got to be watching your hedges just like you do your positions, because like you said, you never know when things are going to zig, you know, and go the opposite way you think, or all of a sudden that correlation breaks down. And the last thing on earth you want to see is, and I've had it happen, you know, where your hedge and your position are going down at the exact same time. And that's really the interesting thing to me about what's going on in markets right now is today is a bit of a microcosm. The correlations have been really breaking down a lot lately. You know, there was a 2-3 week period of time there where you had steadily rising equity prices and steadily rising volatility at the same time. And we rode a volatility hedge at that time for quite a while because, you know, my guys keep saying, are we going to sell it? And I go, we're carrying this thing positively right now, right? I've got free insurance, basically. And then, you know, volatility picked up a little bit, and then we started noticing that volatility wasn't really responding to the market drops either. And so we sold, took some profits, because I just went, okay, this correlation is breaking down for a variety of different reasons, and we need to get the heck out of the way. So, you know, I think you brought up a great point there, which is, you know, keep an eye on your hedges as well, because they can hurt you. In that vein, have you ever had, I mean, you have brought up that story about gold, but have you ever had a hedge hurt you?
Well, I mean, that in effect hurt me because it didn't hurt me much. But like, I'm trying to think, like, generally, there's only one example of a time where I really kind of went not all in, but above. I know, you know, you will have like risk limits, right? The amount you're allowed to invest in certain areas. And as an individual, one can say they have that, but equally one can also bend the rules much more easily than if you're running other people's money. So it's an interesting story. So I became pretty convinced in mid-19 the US was going to slow down. And so I bought a lot of Eurodollar call options because I thought rates would go to zero. And at the time that was, you know, these things can pay out kind of, at the time they were maybe a 10x payout if that happened. And this is very long dated calls. So for like December 20. And then of course what happened was, so that was my hedge, right? My hedge for doomsday was, you know, so I was long equities, long gold, long bonds. I was long a whole bunch of stuff, but like, you know, if basically the world, you know, the economy had a massive issue, my hedge was these things would pay out. Then of course what happened in Q4 was we had this little kind of an early Q1, this kind of reflationary, whatever you want to call it, kind of moment where bond yields were going up, and these were getting absolutely killed. And anyone that's traded these instruments know that, you know, you can be break even on it one day and a week later you could be down 50%, like easy. And I had to, and this was kind of maybe December 19. And then I started hearing about this virus thing in China. There are advantages sometimes to being out here because I definitely heard about it before it was being talked about because people were talking about it. This was in like late December, early Jan. And then I started to, so my hedge had gone way against me and I'd put too much into it. But I suddenly realized actually, what, you know, here's an opportunity to, you know, let's literally every day look at all the numbers, which at the time were only coming out of China, read all the papers that were being produced. And they were being published by, they were Chinese scientists writing them. Well, of course they were, because it was in China. But they were being published in Western journals like The Lancet and JAMA. So I read all these and worked out that, you know what, this thing's probably going to spread. And my rule was, as soon as it hit two countries outside that were major countries, that's when it was a good time to maybe double down on my hedge. And my hedge was way against me. So, of course, rule number one is don't double down on things going against you, right?
Right.
So, of course, I broke that rule. And Iran and Italy happened. And then I'm like, right, that's it. I said, even better. It's on, not better. I mean, it's bad, but it's like it's on two separate continents. So, like, you know, this thing is going to spread. And then I doubled down, tripled down on that, which was a pretty gutsy move at the time. And now, of course, it worked out fantastically. But it's an example of how a hedge can, you know, if you have long-term hedges like that was, the emotional roller coaster that, and a lot of people were in that trade. And I've spoken to a lot of them and, well, a lot, maybe five or six people that were in a similar trade. And it was just incredibly hard for people to stick with it. And a lot of people didn't. So, you know, a lot of the time with these types of hedges, you've got to have the mental discipline to, you know, 'cause it can go, it will go against you, right? If the other things are going up, right?
Yeah. Hedge. Yeah.
And it's just, I think a lot of people underestimate, the mental discipline required.
I put out a tweet about this the other day and, you know, I've been there before. I've been a newbie at this and I've heard the old gray guys warn me, you know, layer into a position. You're like, yeah, I know what's going. I'm pressing the bet. And I just, the risk management aspect of it is so critical, right? I mean, you know, adhering to your rules, adhering to your stops. There are times we had a deal yesterday where we had a short hedge on the portfolio, it wasn't a big position. It was part of an overall hedging strategy that we had on, and it was a short on the NASDAQ. And we sold it at close of market yesterday because it hit our stop. And today, NASDAQ dropped 3%. That hedge would have been up 11 or something like that. It's just part of the game. It's going to happen. And for every time that happens, though, and I've seen this, you know, the other three or four times that you do it, those rules save you, right? It's not about the individual trade. And you know,
remember those times. That's the problem. The human brain doesn't remember the times when you did the right thing and it did save you something.
Yep.
I'm generalizing. My human brain likes to point out the times where I screwed it up.
Yep.
And I know a lot of other traders that say that. And so then that's why I write a lot of stuff down, which you don't need to do in a PA. Of course, if you're running OPM, other people's money, you actually must have, better record keeping in a lot of this stuff, but in personal accounts, people don't have to. And you sometimes got to remind yourself about the things you got right. Because days like today were brutal for most people. And people that were just like, yeah, I was 100% net short equities. Okay, sure, maybe you were. But equally, those people, you know, I mean, or, you know, 300% net short, right? Like, okay, yes, there's someone that was that.
And do that enough times and you'll go broke.
And you're dead, literally. Yeah. So, I mean, this is where Twitter can be terrible. It can be wonderful in many, you know, FinTwit especially. It can be absolutely wonderful in generating ideas. That's what I use it for.
Yep.
And stress testing some stuff. I deliberately put out some controversial things now and again. I want to see how people react. And I will literally tag the person who I know will react to it. Because it's kind of an interesting, fun debate. But too many people think Twitter's like this investment recommendation engine. And like, you know, oh, I know. And so they're like, well, Brent says dollar up and Luke says dollar down. And this is Brent Johnson and Luke Groman. And the head explodes. And it's...
Well, the other thing, and I know both Luke and Brent, and so I'm not speaking to them, but the other thing that people have to remember is you can't see their P&L. Anybody can say anything they want, right? They could be completely full of it, and truthfully, one of the things I've realized is most are. All you're going to hear about are their winners. They're never going to tell you they're losers, and you're also never going to know if their winners actually happened. You know,
right? But someone like, I mean, I spoke with Brent a couple of weeks ago, and you know, some people literally think he said the dollar's going up, so they think his entire portfolio is 100% like long dollar call options. I mean, of course it's not. By the way, he also said he thought stocks would go up a lot. But people don't remember that bit because it doesn't have a catchy title to it. You know, it's dollar milkshake theory.
Right.
And you know, and it's the same. And again, if you're running other people's money, unless you're a complete, like, well, unless you're probably not going to be running other people's money for very, very long, you know, you can't possibly, it's very hard to take these, like, there are people that do it, but these super concentrated positions. Because that's what hedge funds used to do. So I spoke to someone, an American yesterday, who seeded a lot of the hedge funds in the US in the mid 80s. And he's well known for it. And back then he was paying 6% management fee, 30% performance fee.
Ooh.
And he said, best decision of my life. These guys in the mid 80s were just printing money. It was crazy. But that's when hedge funds were actually hedge funds and they would swing for the stars and go for it. Now they're basically trying to pick up pennies in front of a steamroller and deliver you a 7% annualized return with as little volatility as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I actually hope that changes in the next 10 years too. That would be good to go back to the more swashbuckling days, you know, where they're getting real alpha by taking kind of crazy bets. But again, people should realize that's only going to be a very small allocation from, you know, an institution.
And then the other fascinating thing I think about that too is that people, you know, the average investor has a really hard time understanding that is that, you know, you see some of those returns and you see some of that performance and, you know, everybody's mouth waters, right? And you're like, oh, I want some of that. But they don't remember the fact that to generate those returns, you've got to be able to have a gut of steel because the vault, right? It's part of the deal. I there was a hedge fund manager, and I am blanking on his last name. Really smart guy, Mark.
Well, Mark is not going to narrow it down.
Yeah, that's not. Yeah, that's not the most unique name, right? But anyway, he's and I'm just oh man, I'm kicking myself right now. Anyway, he had a really good track record. Didn't operate his fund for a really long time, but he made a pile. It was in the 2005-06 by going. Huge bet in junior uranium miners. And he ended up, I think it was 07 or 08, he ended up putting up 350% return in a single year. Yep. But the part of the story that nobody reads or remembers is that the prior year he was down 55. You know, it was 07, the market was up. You know, if you're going to go after those wins, and I could have the dates, the years inverted or is right around that, you know, 05 to 07, 08 range. you know, if you want to go after those big swings, they can be had, but you better have a gut of steel, right? You better be able to hang in there because it's not just going to go straight up the vast majority of the time.
This is a super good point, and I've been thinking about this a lot, and which is the whole concept of if you're that type of investor. So we all know you've got to, you know, to accumulate, you've got to concentrate, and to protect, you diversify. That's pretty well known. Mm-hmm. But what I've been thinking a lot about recently is, you know, I've been an entrepreneur many times and an investor that has taken these types of bets, but generally don't take those types of bets. But sometimes they come along, like the euro dollar thing. And that type of investor, in my mind, is an entrepreneur. They're the same mindset of you're taking huge amounts of risk, which obviously you are as an entrepreneur. Everyone will tell you you're crazy, which is, if you're an entrepreneur, if you're not being told you're crazy, you're doing the wrong thing.
Yeah.
And you will have, as an entrepreneur, like, you might not be, you know, your company is probably private, right? So it's not going to have some, like, you know, liquid mark to market, whatever. But the ups and downs are giant in terms of emotions, in terms of everything. And it takes a real type of mindset. So I actually think a lot of entrepreneurs could be fantastic at that type of investing. It's not that fashionable, that type of investing right now, right? But again, a lot of entrepreneurs do invest like that, with their own personal accounts, and have done super duper well. But yeah, you've got to be willing to be 50% down on something one day and 3 days before you were up. I think most people struggle with that.
That's an interesting point. I've never put that correlation together, but you're 100% correct. That is entrepreneurial investing. You're swinging for the fences.
And there we go. You've just named it.
Well, you did it.
I like that. I'm stealing that. So, yeah.
Well, you put it together. So I just combined the words. But no, that's it. It is. And you pointed out another good one. You're an entrepreneur. So am I. How many times have you been called nuts? I've been called nuts. You know, and then when it works out, you know, of course, people look at you and go, boy, you guys are so lucky. And there is an aspect of luck into it. But the other side of it is, go, you know, you didn't live off Top Ramen for 6 years. You know, you right? It is. It's an all or nothing bet. And I look back at, you know, even the start of our firm, and I sit there sometimes and go, you know, I'm really glad I'm here. Would I go through it again? I don't know. I don't know that I would do it again, knowing what that path was, you know. It was, and I'm sure you've got tons of stories like that. I mean, is your experience different than that?
No, it's the same. I mean, you always think, I'm not going to do it again, and then you do. but also, I think...
do this again 6 months later, right?
And the thing is, but you would if you could also turn back time. So with today's mentality you have, maybe you wouldn't. But if you could go back 10, 15 years to how you were thinking back then, you would, right? Yeah. So I think you've got to layer that in too. And you know, unfortunately, we haven't worked out how to travel back in time yet. So, but there's different types of, I mean, from my experiences, there's very different types of entrepreneur too, like in terms of the, you know, there's the BSOS kind of absolutely focused on a crazy huge vision, you know, that will literally take decades. And he's going to do it for decades. And I would also argue if he was hit by a bus, Amazon would be fine because he's also built an incredible team.
Yeah.
And that's one type of that person is doing the same thing for 30 years. And then there's the other type, which I'm more like, which is like, you know, get really, really interested in something for 2, 3, 4 years, get something going, and then realize probably not the best person to be actually scaling it. And so then, you know, go and start doing something else because, you know, you've got to know what you're bad at as well.
That is such a good point. And I have seen that both in some of our private equity investments, and I've seen it in this industry, and I've experienced it in my own business, that the guy that is the best at getting it off the ground is very seldom the best operator.
Correct. But they can be. There are examples.
Yeah.
But it's quite rare.
And that's what makes Bezos such an interesting character, right?
I think he's one of the greatest entrepreneurs of all time. I mean, no question.
Yeah.
I mean, you can love or hate Amazon, but at the end of the day, he's built something which if you live in a country where Amazon is important, so let's just say US, pretty hard not to use it.
Oh, geez. It's almost impossible. Okay. Well, while we've still got a little bit of time left, and I don't want to squeeze us, but Bitcoin, wanted to get to that before we were done here. You know, you don't even have to go too deep into it. I just want to hear your take on Bitcoin because, again, I think it's interesting to talk to you about it because of your location, your different, you know, the different way you view it. And then also talk to you about, you know, how is Bitcoin viewed in your part of the world? So kind of give us your Bitcoin breakdown and how involved you are in it, what your beliefs are, you know, just give us, I just want to hear you riff on this. And because I think you have a very interesting perspective, your background, your history, your involvement in financial markets, and then also your geographic location. And that's something I was really interested in getting to and asking you about. So give us your Bitcoin breakdown, would you?
Sure. So I've been involved in cryptocurrencies since kind of 2013, 14. Actually, the first I ever bought was not Bitcoin, although I had to buy Bitcoin to buy the first one I bought, which was a thing called Stellar. On the day it came out, and I had to use some obscure Swedish exchange. I was in London at the time, and it was like a complete nightmare to, and you were sending them money and you're like, am I ever gonna see this again? But this was back in 13 or 14. I can't remember exactly when it was Wild West. And then I bought Bitcoin very soon after that. After it had kind of, it had gone up to about 1300 and it crashed down to like 200. And I'm like, okay, I'd started researching it. I'm like, oh, okay, well, this thing's gone down about 85%. I'm like, that's what the NASDAQ had gone down in 2000. This could be interesting. Why not just put some money into it, see what happens? And that was kind of that for a couple of years. And then I started getting much more, and back then it was like not talked about in mainstream, right? It was just a bunch of geeks. But there were people building very interesting infrastructure around it. But then, of course, 17 happened, which was kind of crazy, and a classic kind of bubble. And again, with a classic correction after the bubble. And again, it went down 85%. It's kind of amazing. So it's not like tulips. Tulips didn't go down 85%. They went down 100%.
Right.
Seashells did not go down 85%. They went down 100%. So Bitcoin's had these long-term cycles about every 4 years. Probably, we don't know for sure, but probably because every 4 years, it's like halving the amount of gold mined every year in the world. So roughly gold inflates at 2% a year, roughly. And so in 4 years' time, if gold were Bitcoin, it would inflate at 1% a year. And then 4 years after that, 0.5% a year. So it's got a known monetary policy.
Right.
So it's the first asset to have a known monetary policy forevermore, and that's enshrined in code. Now, I understand code can be changed, but it's incredibly hard for that to be changed. It would require, in effect, for Bitcoin's inflation schedule to change, would require a lot of people that own a lot of Bitcoin to shoot themselves in the foot. And do I trust basic economics? If it was run by a government, sure, it could change it in a heartbeat, but it's not. It's actually run by no one. And in some ways run by everyone because it's decentralized. So I just thought it was an interesting technology. At first, the narrative was very much around digital cash. And this is where Bitcoin has a catch-22. So if you want something to be really secure, i.e. a blockchain to be very secure and cheap to use, it's also very hard for it to be very fast. It's very hard to optimize all three points of that triangle. And also, for it to be used as a day-to-day currency, you need, i.e. I just go to Starbucks and buy something with it. What a lot of people don't realize is one of the reasons that didn't happen was Bitcoin holders did not want to spend their Bitcoin because right. They thought it would be worth more in the future. So they were happy to just sit on it. So no one wants to spend it. We've all heard of Pizza Guy that, he actually bought two pizzas for $30 back in 2010. It just so happens that would be worth $100 million today. But at the time, it was worth $30. So Bitcoin is like options. You go down this rabbit hole and how I've described it over the years has changed almost every year. And so then it went to this kind of store of value was the next argument, or kind of narrative. And it's fairly hard to say something's a store of value if it loses 85% of its value. That kind of price action kind of said, well, it's volatility is just not there yet. Maybe one day it will have the same volatility as gold, or indeed lower. But at the time, its volatility was triple figures every day. And right. So, I mean, and by the way, you know, like silver right now is up at like 70 or so volatility. I mean, you know, it's the
trader's dream.
Oil went to, what, 300 or something nuts recently. I mean, that was a very bespoke kind of situation with the negative pricing. But
yeah,
Bitcoin was trading day in, day out at triple figure volatility. So it's, I think it's, and that, but this was when it started colliding with the financial markets. So, i.e. you had the futures come out, which was in December 17. So CME futures, highly regulated. In fact, there is no better run futures market in terms of, you know, that was a big stamp of approval, except it crashed the price because it was in a bubble. And so what you've then seen from then is a general decrease in volatility. You can just, I think it's BVOL is the ticker. To look at Bitcoin volatility, it's generally trended down. It absolutely has spikes. But in the long run, you want to see, you want to be long assets that are structurally trending down in volatility. That's like general rule for any asset.
Mm-hmm.
And more, and then what you've had is the emergence of Ethereum and smart contracts. And all smart contracts are, it sounds fancy, but it's not really. It's just some computer code. It's like you can program a banknote. So I can give you, or indeed program a digital, you know, some digital money that's, you know, in an account. So basically, if this happens, then do this. And you've basically wrapped that banknote with it, or gold bar, or whatever you want to think of it as. Except what do you wrap with it? Well, you wrap Bitcoin or Ether or whatever it might be. And so then that meant people realized, well, okay, so I can now do some really cool things. And this allowed the DeFi movement, so decentralized finance. So as of today, you've got almost $10 billion of, so $10 billion US dollars of cryptocurrencies that are staked, i.e. they're kind of wrapped in these contracts, and they're allowing people to borrow money, get interest, and do all sorts of interesting things. Some of the things are crazy, some of them are kind of boring. But that's kind of the first kind of real use, and that's $10 billion real dollars, in that you could absolutely take what's staked and convert that to US dollars instantly, because it's a super liquid market. So it's not like it's some funny money. I mean, that can be converted. And so where this leads you towards, and so what's interesting is the first use case, kind of digital cash, well, that wasn't really what it was. But then again, when the internet was born in the 70s, well, it looked very different by the 90s, right? In the 2000s. And then you had this store of value, which got a little bit, the narrative got violated with a gigantic drawdown. And then it just sort of organically happened because Ethereum came out to come into this next generation where, okay, so we can use this as pristine collateral, which is where it kind of, a lot of the thinking is now. So I can't rehypothecate that Bitcoin. So if I stake it and wrap it in a smart contract, I can't do that again. So it's not like I could pledge the same asset five times. It's not possible due to how it all works. And that's really, really interesting because the world, especially in Asia, to answer your geographic point, has a big problem, as 2008 showed, with who on earth knows who owns what collateral, how much of it is double, triple, quadruple staked. People are generally having to just say they're not double staking it, but they can be. And in Asia, it's a huge problem. And, you know, 08 showed a lot of how dirty the laundry is on this. So the latest kind of argument I'd have is you could well become the world's most pristine collateral. And ultimately, what that could mean is, what's the world's most pristine collateral now? It's U.S. treasuries. It's basically short-term U.S. treasuries. Well, with all going on in the world and everything, central banks, you know, basically creating and printing trillions of dollars of whatever the currency they're in, one can make an argument that that's a very logical place for it to go. And it's a very long story, but the point is, everything of the above just happened organically. It just is like, it's just like when the internet in the 90s, you know, it was very different from the beginning to the end. And why? Well, because internet speeds sped up, you know. So what was possible in 2000 wasn't possible in 1990, and the same for 2010. And I think a lot of people on Bitcoin forget that it's ultimately software code. So it's getting upgraded all the time. Some people want it to be upgraded faster. Some people want it to be slower. But it's a living, breathing thing. And whilst I am long gold, at the end of the day, gold is a lump of metal. And it has value because we say it does. And it has lots of history. But it is still, gold is still going to be gold, because if you change it, it's not gold. So, you know, there are some very well-known people in macro like Raoul Powell and people who are super duper long these things, and a lot of hedge funds have started putting a few percent. We've had the MicroStrategy thing that happened 2 or 3 weeks ago, where the CEO and founder changed about their entire treasury of $450 million from US dollars to Bitcoin.
I saw that.
He'd done masses of research, and he's done a few interviews recently, and it's fascinating listening to him. I mean, the guy's, he's a geek, right? He founded a SaaS company, but he wasn't an early Bitcoin adopter. So he just dived into it. And, you know, so at the end of the day, you've got 21 million maximum coins. In reality, it's more like 17 or 18 million, because a few million have been lost, and it's very, very hard for them to ever be found. And it's got a known depreciation schedule for evermore. And it's, you know, it's probably going to become the hardest hard asset. And it's super liquid. So it has a lot of interesting traits, but it's volatile. I mean, you know, right now it tends to trade with correlations more with the NASDAQ than anything else, but it has periods where it trades quite correlated with gold. So it's very schizophrenic. It doesn't really, you know, its correlation can shift in a heartbeat. So, you know, but most experienced macro traders that have kind of got into it that I know, they don't trade it. They just sit on it and forget about it.
Yeah. It's
a 10-year thing. Don't be the hero trying to trade this thing. It's really hard.
Right. It's the old adage back in the days when we had stock certificates, right? Take that certificate, put it in your nightstand and just forget it's there.
Yes.
And that's the fascinating thing about it is, and I don't own any, our clients don't, I'm waiting for a pullback because I'm going to pick up some.
But why don't you just buy yourself? Like,
I'm probably
just $10 worth. This is the kind of point earlier on. If you have something, or maybe not $10, whatever, but the point, a small amount.
Yeah.
It just means you have something. It means you've had to go through the process and you suddenly start to care a little bit more about it each day.
Right.
That's what I say to a lot of people is, yeah, don't go and just dump like 80% of your net worth into this tomorrow. That's like probably not the smart thing to do.
Right. Right.
You know.
Well, and the reason that I think, and again, I'm not, you know, there is no guaranteed deal, right? There's no guarantees.
Of course not.
You know, but that being said, once you really start getting into it and understanding it, you understand the dynamics, and you understand that even if the adoption rate is much slower than forecasted, there's only so much, right? And like by default over time, unless something, you know, again, unless something changes, but you look at it, the fascinating thing to me is, like you said, and I'm not prepared to say it's the ultimate hard asset.
Sure. Well, it might not be.
It might not be, but the way it's structured, it is. Right. It's completely deflationary, you know, eventually. Right. I mean,
yes, but yeah.
And there's just not going to be any more. And that is the aspect of it to me, because I am my wife refers to me as the oldest 38-year-old on the planet. And so
my wife might have said the same about me.
So, okay. Yeah. Okay. So I'm in good company, but I am the ultimate old school thinker. And so I'm always skeptical of new things. And there's that part of me that looks at it and just says, okay, but the things you like about gold, if we forget that it's gold and we forget the history, which that's a really long history, and I'm not prepared to forget that history of gold, and you're not either. You're obviously
no, correct. As well. Absolutely. To be clear to listeners, I'm roughly, in terms of my liquid assets, I have almost identical allocation to gold to Bitcoin.
Yeah, so well,
I don't have a fight in this. And the reason I say that is people might be thinking, oh, he's just a Bitcoiner. No, no, no. I really don't care which quote unquote wins, and they might both win or they might both lose.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't have a stick in that fight. So,
but here is the one thing that I will say for sure, that when you look at both, I will say this, that the Bitcoin trade has infinitely more it is infinitely more asymmetric, right?
Correct.
I mean, the upside is, I mean, truly, you know, it is essentially limitless. Just due to the structure of it, due to the fact that if it really catches on, if it really becomes, and at some point it will probably have to become somewhat of a medium of exchange, right, to be really successful. But it doesn't mean that that will diminish the value it has to the people that hold it. And
there's an interesting point there, because I like thinking of it as, I think in America you call them checking accounts, and you got savings accounts.
Yep.
Is that right?
Yep. You got it.
And so, I could argue that in the checking account side, i.e. for day-to-day usage, I've had a Starbucks, I bought some coffee or whatever, right? That can be the dollar for a long time or not. It's fine, but that's not necessarily the most interesting part. Like the savings account, which would put collateral into that too, is kind of, I think, more interesting in terms of, that's when you're starting to talk about store value properties, and you know, all the stuff we just talked about. And by the way, gold and Bitcoiners share 95% of the argument. It drives me insane to see people online.
So do I.
When the last 5%, okay, there's different routes. I get it. But it's like a broadband. Or fiber optic.
They agree up to the...
You know,
you're fighting the same enemy.
Just disagree on the last mile.
Yeah, you're fighting the same enemy and you're using different guns. Right, I mean, that's essentially what it is. Like you're scared of the same thing. You've got the same concerns. You see the same glitch in the matrix, and you're just attacking it at different vectors. Right, and I've had that point from the very beginning. I was like, guys, these are brothers. This is not oppositional.
Correct.
And one doesn't hurt the other one. The interesting thing that I'll bounce past you though, because I was having a conversation with another one of my buddies. Who is actually Chase Taylor, Pinecone Macro. Are you familiar with him?
No.
Okay. Anyway, he's on Twitter.
I'll check
him out, sir. Yeah. He's a great follow. Great guy. He and I were having this conversation on watching the way it's traded. I think that Bitcoin is going to have a tough time really breaking loose from this, until this craziness or this stock mania is over in the techs. Now, I could be completely wrong, but I think a lot of that hot money has, my theory, and I don't have anything to back this up, but my theory is a lot of that hot money that was rolling into Bitcoin and driving it up to 20, I think a lot of that same type of thinking is what's flowing into Peloton and Zoom and Tesla and Nikola and all that kind of stuff. So I think what I'm looking at right now, and you said it's correlated to NASDAQ, I think it's going to be, and I think maybe there's going to be a painful ride, hopefully a good entrance point for me selfishly. But at some point that correlation is going to break, because I think that money is going to flow back. That's my personal take. You got any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, look, I guess one could also argue the real correlation here is a negative one to the US dollar. Because, you know, if in dollar up days, which we've had in the last few weeks, you know, generally this has not been good for stocks and not been good for gold, and not been good for Bitcoin, and really not good for silver, which is actually, even in the last few days, has gone down more than Bitcoin. It's again showing it's more volatile right now, which is very interesting, because a few years ago that was not the case. You know, Bitcoin would have been going up and down by 50% a day, and it's been a few percent. So again, like, people should also look, I mean, for example, you said Bitcoin's new. I would also argue, well, it's not new. It's been around 11 years.
Yeah, you know, that's true.
Is that new? Do people think Facebook's new? Facebook's been around since 05, maybe 04, you could argue. Like, so now, of course, in relation to gold, quite clearly it's new, because gold's got thousands of years of history.
That's a great point. And I haven't thought about it in that light, though. Due to the time it's been around and the fact that we're still sitting here looking at $10,200 Bitcoin, it's really hard to make the argument that it's still in this parabolic bubble and it's worthless. Because structurally speaking, it's not, right?
It's one of the most technical charts. If you plot it,
absolutely.
The annoying thing about it is you have to plot it on a log scale. And I'm a scientist, right? Plotting on a log scale and drawing lines on charts is kind of a little silly. But you can't plot it on a linear scale, because it's gone up like a millionfold. So, but it's technically on a log scale. It gets technicians very excited. It actually trades quite technically, apart from sometimes some crazy vol up and down. It's a technician's dream, actually. And it's retested, you know, all sorts of previous highs. And like I said, it's Seychelles went to zero. NASDAQ didn't go to zero. It went down 85%.
Right.
And then what emerged ultimately was the next generation. You know, back in 2000, the world's biggest companies were banks and energy companies and people like GE. And now all the world's biggest companies are tech companies. Now, that wasn't popular in 2002 to say that.
No, but it is amazing how that's played out. You're right. It didn't go to zero. And as a matter of fact, it's already retraced. Well, we got up to 12, didn't we? I mean, that represents a...
14 since... 14 is the lower high since the 20,000 high.
Yeah,
but that was very fleeting for like half a day. It was, you know,
that's like a 60% retracement, right? I mean, that's something that no other bubble asset has ever done, right? I mean...
Well, that's because it's not a bubble asset.
Right. No, this is my point. Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty simple. People don't like that sometimes. But again, look at the chart. Put it back since inception, and there's there's pretty good data from 11 onwards. Because I mean, at first there was no data, but it didn't matter. It was like 3 cents. Just consider if you want to call it Buttcoin or whatever. Which again, when most people call it this, they don't know much about it. And by the way, if someone does know lots about it and has come to that conclusion, that's totally cool.
Well, here's the other thing too. Is it all that different than believing that Facebook, a social media site, could actually become a financial juggernaut, right? Like, all people just are talking about their own lives, posting pictures of their kids. They're never going to be able to make any money. You know what I mean? Like, it's...
Which, by the way, everyone said.
Yeah, including me.
Google, they all said, well, this is great, but this is impossible to monetize, except they literally came up with the greatest business model of all time. Type what you want into a box, and we will sell you stuff. That's Google.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah,
literally the best business model of the last 100 years, and I genuinely mean that. Except in 2000, people were like, nah, this search can't, you know, it's impossible to monetize. Like, so people think very linearly generally, and this relates to this whole entrepreneurial investor thing, which is that I would argue if someone puts a not like a 0.1% allocation to Bitcoin, because even if it goes up 100x, that's not going to have like a massive impact on portfolio. And it could absolutely go down to zero. But it certainly has the potential to go up a gigantic amount.
No, but a 2.5% position in overall portfolio, that can get you done.
Sure. So someone like a Keith McCullough, a hedge guy, says, well, it's a commodity. My maximum position in the commodity is 4%. So my maximum position is 4%. Okay,
yeah.
This is process, perfectly reasonable.
Yep.
I'm higher than that, significantly higher, but then I've also held it for a long time, and it just went up, so it kind of naturally became more. I know some people who are above 50%, who are not kind of long-term Bitcoin holders, which some would say is kind of, maybe that's crazy. But equally, they're taking that entrepreneurial investing approach, which is, well, you know what? Like, I've done my homework. I believe in it. It's not just belief. I can look at the data every day on it. I can see who's using it, what's going on with what's called the hash rate, i.e. how... Because what it really is the world's most secure computer network, which doesn't get talked about so much because it's getting a bit geeky. But that's why it's so interesting for collateral, because Bitcoin has never been hacked. Exchanges have been hacked, but that's the same as a bank being robbed. That happens, by the way, still 15 times a day in the US. So let's just not get into that stupid discussion on, you know, exchanges were just poor web code like Mt. Gox and whatever. But the actual core Bitcoin blockchain has never been hacked. It doesn't mean to say it's not hackable, because probably everything is hackable. But it hasn't been. I just think it's from all the potential macro investments right now, it's a fascinating one, because if you want to have that entrepreneurial investing mindset, it's one where you don't need to use leverage, which is really interesting too, because you don't need to buy a call option on Bitcoin.
No, it's
have
leverage,
the time
maybe.
Decay. Well, but there's no need. If something has a potential to give you a 10 or 100x or more, like genuinely that is possible. I'm not saying it's probable, but yeah, you certainly don't need to use leverage, and the volatility is still quite high. So, you know, buying long-term options is very expensive.
Yeah,
there is a market.
You don't need any more convexity than it offers.
Exactly. So you can just have it and leave it. Forget about it.
No, I've long said, Chris, and I mean, you can feel free to disagree, but I've long said that, look, if Bitcoin is left to run its course, I just do not see how it doesn't go higher. The only real threat I see, and I cannot articulate how this would happen, which is why I will buy some, because, you know, you can't not invest in something because something unknown might go wrong. But the threat that I've always seen is the central bankers' chokehold on the economy. And my belief that they're going to have an incredible unwillingness to give that control up, right? The ability, I mean, they're like the modern day shaman, right, of the economy, meaning they can conjure money out of thin air. And, you know, once you've got that ability, which no one has really had in history, you know, you're not going to likely give that up without a fight. And I've always seen the biggest threat being government, that if this thing is let to run on its own, I don't, when you understand the structure, I don't see how much, much, much higher isn't just baked into the cards, right? I just don't see how that's possible.
But I agree. That's a very valid. So there are some people in Bitcoin who would try and dismiss what you say, but let's be honest, like, if all governments in the world, so really the weak point of the Bitcoin ecosystem is the whole fiat into crypto, right? So it's getting money into a bank account, i.e. real money, real USD or whatever it is, that can then be sent to an exchange and then you can transfer to Bitcoin. Once you have the Bitcoin, you can do anything you want in crypto and it's trivial because you never need to touch fiat again. But that's the weakness in the system. And who ultimately regulates that system? It is governments.
Yeah.
So for me, the biggest attack vector for Bitcoin is not because over 50% of the mining is in China. There are many ways that, and we're going back to China, right? That, first of all, this is also a $200 billion asset class. This is not even like, I mean, the Fed printed that literally in a day.
So, right, right.
You know,
right.
Let's also be very clear that gold is two magnitudes more, you know, in terms of whatever, you know, 12, 13, 14 billion, whatever it is these days. Trillion. And so for me, the biggest, and again, what you've got to do is probability weight these things, which again involves some guesswork, but the whole what's called a 51% attack on Bitcoin, which is that the miners start producing blocks that basically say that they own more than they really do. And if you could coerce lots of miners to do this, yeah, this is a possible attack. But if it happened, literally about 10 million Twitter bots would go off instantly. And the whole decentralized apparatus would start to orphan the blocks that these guys are putting out. Yes, there might be a few issues for a few hours or a few days on Bitcoin, but it would actually be quite quickly resolved. The much more difficult problem is if there's a coordinated government response to say, let's all work together, because you can't just have one government doing it, because then other governments will say, like us, Switzerland have said, or Cayman have said, or Gibraltar, or Hong Kong, Singapore, like, okay, we like this innovation, so if US wants to try and ban this, why don't you come to us and do your transactions here, and we'll support it, and because they see it as a way to get ahead. So the only way around that is to have a genuine global coordinated response that say bans all fiat exchanging, you know, moving to exchanges in order to be able to sell it to Bitcoin. And I mean, the world can't really agree anything right now, but I guess it is possible. So one shouldn't think it's not possible. Very interesting to that, though, is, for example, this is literally a new narrative in the last few weeks for me, but in oil and gas production, you know that people often flare the gas because it's actually not economic for them to liquefy and pipe right. Or whatever the gas, but then they just have the oil coming out. So this happens a lot in the US. You see, and they're flaring gas, which literally is just burning energy for absolutely nothing, is also bad for the environment. Okay, fine, put that aside. But you know, economically, it's quite obvious they're just chucking money away. I mean, and there's a lot of gas. And so there are some enterprising companies now, mainly in America, who are like, right, well, we're going to rock up with our 28-foot storage container. It's a self-contained Bitcoin mining farm. It's got giant fans on the side to keep it cool. And we're also going to rock up with another container, which is a generator, which means you just put that gas into this generator. We're going to mine Bitcoin right here. It's just like mining gold, but anywhere, because you can only mine gold where there is gold. Or enough gold to be economic. But Bitcoin to mine, you just need an internet connection and electricity and some hardware. So very interesting that one of my predictions for the next, I don't make many predictions, but this seems to be pretty obvious. Like, why wouldn't oil and gas producers who are just flaring away this wasted energy, they can now use that very simply to create something of value. And whether or not you don't like the price of Bitcoin, it does have a value. The market tells us it's value. And then suddenly they're going to be investing more and more capex into monetizing what they used to just throw away. And that means ultimately, if that really catches on, and I don't really see any logical reason why it wouldn't, you get things like the oil and gas industry suddenly very incentivized to want Bitcoin to be a success. Well, what's the biggest lobbying industry in the world? It's probably oil and gas. Mm-hmm. It's not tobacco these days. It might be tech now, you're right. But, you know, yeah, that's true. But this is again, the nonlinear thought, which is, I don't think anything I've said there is that controversial. It's actually just they threw away energy. Now they can create something. And by the way, you could say, well, if there's gold in the ground, mine the gold. Well, the thing is, you know what? There probably isn't gold in the ground. Because gold and Bitcoin ultimately are ways of using energy to get something of value. Now, you can't reverse engineer gold or Bitcoin to get energy. So it's not a battery. But, you know, it's a one-way thing. If the oil and gas industry are suddenly lobbying governments to say, no, you can't possibly do this. Like, we need this to have value. We've invested, you know, tens of billions of dollars in capex, and this type of stuff's happening. But it's happening slowly at first, and it will just happen all of a sudden, just like, you know, Facebook's growth or whatever. So it gets, again, we've gone way down. I didn't know we were going to get to this. This is way down the rabbit hole, but it's kind of fascinating stuff. But it's also quite logical stuff. And it doesn't matter if you love or hate the thing. Why are you burning something and chucking it away when you can create money from it and increase your margins? Well, that's how businesses think. So
that's a fascinating point.
It's one of those things which, like, and I'm laughing because I would never have given any of these answers 5-6 years ago. I would have just given a very one-dimensional answer. And then, but someone could then also fairly criticize, saying, well, therefore, Chris, you don't have a clue what it's about because you keep changing your mind. Well, it's because it's an invention and we haven't worked out yet where it's really ultimately going to be. Just like the internet took decades to actually work out what its key reasons for being were. And we're already 11 years in. Things tend to happen a bit faster these days because of the internet. You know, we're now seeing the first real use cases of the decentralized finance, and now it can actually help solve some other problems that even companies like an oil and gas company have. I just think everyone should, you know, it's fascinating. And the good thing about it is there's tons of content out there, good content on this. You know, you've got a very passionate community. The best content is the ones that are, you know, try and make the arguments both ways. And are honest about, you know, the things that can go wrong. I mean, there could be a technical issue with it. It hasn't happened yet, but it's possible.
It has been remarkably rock solid. And in that way, it surprised me. And I remember the day it was launched. I also remember the first day that the first transaction, somebody bought a pizza and I think it cost them 90 Bitcoin. If I remember correctly.
Oh, no. It was 10,000 Bitcoin.
Oh, yeah. Most expensive pizza in the history of
mankind.
No,
it cost him $30. It was two pizzas, and it cost him $30 at the time.
Oh, there you go. Unbelievable.
But now it's $100 million.
That made me sick.
By the way, that guy is very well known, the Bitcoin pizza guy. He is not bitter because, by the way, he didn't use all his Bitcoin. And he's like, you know what? I proved this thing could buy something.
Yeah.
And he will be forever that person. And he's a quite well-known guy. He's super cool.
Wonder what the owner of the pizza joint did with it. Probably cashed it in.
Almost certainly were like, well, you know what? It was very difficult back then. This was 2011, I think. So it wasn't so easy. He must have already liked Bitcoin, else he would never have taken that transaction. So maybe he had a way to cash it out, but maybe he kept it. But wouldn't it be cool if he kept it? That would be so cool.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I made $400 million selling a pizza, right? Or, awesome. Or whatever it is, $100 million.
But that's, in effect, what MicroStrategy just did, right?
Yeah.
Is, oh, okay, obviously the price now is not a few cents or whatever, but like that's, in you know, if corporations realize for their... So if you're Apple or whoever and you've got $100 billion plus of... What it really is short-term treasury bills. I mean, they don't keep cash. It's short-term treasury bills, which is, in effect, cash. If you start looking with all that's going on in terms of debasement of fiat currency, do you really want to have that amount of money in that in the long run? Or are you going to start looking at other ways? And again, MicroStrategy was, we're getting 100% pretty much in Bitcoin. I'm not saying that's going to be common. But like... Why won't an Apple or whoever start, you know, again, they understand the technology, maybe put a few percent, like you say, 2.5%, whatever it might be, you know, just managing the treasury in slightly different ways. Because if we're going to go into a world where central banks will print any amount of money, and again, that's not necessarily inflationary, but they will produce, basically create any amount of money to kind of keep economies going. Because they just do not want to have the kind of the pain of the reset, which of course has to come eventually. Then, yeah, people like MicroStrategy will be the next generation of Bitcoin pizza guy.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's fascinating. Yeah,
no, it's fascinating. Well, hey, pal, we have run way over. You know what, yeah. Man? This is now this holds the record for my longest interview, and I enjoyed the heck out of it to the point where I didn't even realize we were this far over. So I know you're a busy guy. I've got a family that probably is wondering where in the heck I am. But anyway, fascinating conversation. I'm really glad we followed up and did this, and I can't thank you enough for coming on. Chris, where can people follow you? We've got your Twitter handle, and I'm trying to pull it up right here. I follow you, and I'm just blanking out on your Twitter handle. Will you give the folks your Twitter handle?
Yeah, so it's at Darky999. So my surname is Dark. So I was called Darky when I was a kid, D-A-R-K-Y. I'm well aware 20 years later this may not be the greatest but I was literally, that was my nickname.
But he came again, by it honestly. It's his last name.
I mean, it really is my last name.
Yeah, yeah.
And
then
and I know you've been on it, but my podcast is called Dr. Dark After Dark. And that's on every podcast thing. And that's really very similar to what we've just done, except kind of I'm in your seat. It's just a discussion with no agenda, just, you know, generally kind of interesting people from macro, and sometimes we go a bit off piste.
Well, and I don't know, and I enjoy it too. I can't recommend the podcast enough, man. And I like you. I like the approach you take, and I like the flexibility of it. You know, sometimes you hear these podcasts and they're so regimented. I really enjoy that freewheeling and free floating conversation that you guys have, and I think it's really a differentiator. And it's fascinating because you and I both know, you know, some of the roads and rabbit holes we just went down. You know, some of the best stuff comes out in that freewheeling environment. And no, I love your work, love what you're doing, and can't thank you enough for coming on. And I'd encourage everybody to follow him on Twitter and also check out the podcast and subscribe like I do. And Chris, it's been a pleasure, and I am hopeful and pretty positive this won't be the last time. So thanks again for joining us and getting up a little early, and I hope to have you on again, pal.
Great. It's been great fun. Thanks very much, Zach.
Hey, you bet. All right, you guys, we got to run. That's it. Thank you for sticking with us and listening to the interview. And like I said, give Chris a follow on Twitter. Sign up for that podcast, and you won't regret it. Anyway, have a wonderful weekend, and we'll be back next week. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH and 97.3 Cairo FM.
Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.